See, he has start.
Aldous have to do something now.
Of course you do.
Saying, you know, the actual conversation begins at.
That's right. You always say that in your when you do your summary.
Because if it's yeah, because I had a few stars and where did the conversation begin? Well, you have to sort of stay in there.
I hope people are expecting this call to start tonight. Hi, who's there?
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Who's there?
It's Michael Eisinger.
Hi, Michael. We're glad to have you on the call.
Thank you.
Always, but especially tonight. I was just saying to Rich Gardner, who's our tech, that I'm hoping that people realize that this is the second Tuesday. You know,
you're fading in and out. I can hardly hear you.
Okay. I'm just talking to myself, you know. I need to project. You are projecting very nicely, sir. I was just, you know, when you're an organizer, you always worry. So I'm just thinking of, I hope people realize it's the second Tuesday. And when we sent our blast out, Andrea Miller and I kind of did it a little, not the usual form, and we didn't put in the subject line the conference call. So I'm a little nervous that people may not know it's tonight. They may think it's next Tuesday. That's all. Last minute worries.
Well, we will make do with whatever, and if need be, reschedule.
So Barbara Lee and Walter Jones have a letter out. You saw that. You know, aimed at NATO, and Obama's going to NATO. Saying
the letter calls for what?
Expedited withdrawal.
So it follows her bill, basically.
Yeah, but it's the letter.
780. This is not the amendment. This is a dear colleague letter.
No, I understand that. But, I mean, it's along the same political lines.
Yes, although she has a paragraph there that says, though a lot of us would like to see the withdrawal immediate, what we're asking for in this particular letter is that at NATO you work on an expedited withdrawal.
Right.
Two more.
So that's, you know, that's the somewhat compromised language that I guess she hopes to get more traction with.
Hey, Sally, it's Virginia.
Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Did somebody else come on that needs to say their name?
Yeah, hi, from Chuck in Detroit.
Hi, Chuck. Chuck Altman.
Right.
Hi. Who is this, please?
Hello, this is Glenn Sandberg in Gulfport, Mississippi, and I think I will be a passive listener on this call pretty much. We don't have a progressive Democrats group here, but I would like to organize one if it's possible.
Well,
yes, I've
great.
Talked to you on the telephone before. You haven't been on the calls for a while, I think. Or have you?
Well, I've signed up for some calls and then didn't quite get back to it when it happened.
Okay.
And anyway, tomorrow we're having an event that might be of interest to help elect Norman Solomon, and that's a call that's going to follow this one starting at 9:30 at night here. In
right,
Central
and that's
time.
Tonight.
Yeah, but
right.
Then the event is going to be tomorrow 7:00. And
that's
I'm hoping
good.
To get some people to RSVP and come here for that.
Very good.
So so I will mute and listen.
Okay, Glenn.
Bye.
Is Michael on the call?
Yes, Michael's on the
call. I am.
Who else?
Michael Eisinger?
Yes, he is. Who else is on the call that would like to say their name, please? Chuck, were you able to, did you get the notice of the call, and did you listen to Lieutenant Colonel Davis's testimony that was linked on that blast? Do you know what I'm talking about? Chuck Altman?
What's that?
Is this Chuck?
Yes.
Yeah, are you aware of what I'm talking about when I talk about Lieutenant Colonel Davis and a video that was linked on the blast about this call?
Yes.
Oh, good. Have you had a chance to look at that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's something, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly widely known information.
That's surprising.
Pardon? Say again. I wasn't sure if you said it was surprising or not surprising.
Not surprising.
Yeah. But certainly not transparent.
No.
I have sort of a bad feeling about that this people don't know about that the call is tonight. I began to get that feeling about it only about an hour ago. What? Yes, but it didn't in the subject line of the blast, it did not say conference call, and it actually didn't even say it right at the beginning. So I was thinking there was going to be a second blast over the weekend like there usually is, but so the blast about this call came on Friday, and it was not explicit enough.
Right,
Andrea and I were experimenting, I guess you'd say. We haven't had this experience before. It's not a nice experience.
No, we don't have too many on yet.
And Michael Eisinger, before you came on, Virginia, suggested the word, doing it again,
Doing what?
Well, sort of postponing the call and having it a week later, I think is what the intent was.
I could not do that. Yeah. We have our endorsement meeting next Tuesday for our candidate here.
I would have zero objections to doing that.
You would have zero objections? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's awfully quiet. We had a lot of people last month, and it matters how those announcements go out. Well, the other way is to go ahead with the call and then advertise the recording of it heavily.
Yeah, we can even post the link on Facebook and on the various media sites.
Virginia, I can't hear you tonight. Can you talk into your phone more?
Sure. I was going to say we could then post the link to this call on the various Facebook sites for PDA.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, I'm willing to go whatever direction you want to go in.
Thank you.
The advantage of having a lot of people on the call is that you have a richer discussion in Q&A. But I'm perfectly content to go forward tonight, or do a little bit tonight and do more later, or whatever.
All right, well, let's see. 8 after, should we go ahead and get started? Is Mark and Sandy on the line?
Mark can't make it. He got his plane got postponed. He knew he would be just barely making it. And it's true that Sandy's not on the call even. Sandy Davies, are you there? That's...
Hello?
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 Came on.
Yes, this is Sandy Davis in Miami.
Hi, Sandy. Sandy, we have a problem. I think people don't know about this call tonight.
Uh-huh.
I think the second blast that I expected to happen after what Andrea and I did about, we had an email going out. I thought it was an early email to just get people to watch the Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis tape. It didn't have an explicit subject line, and here we are, the 8th of May doesn't feel like the second Tuesday, sort of in people's rhythm, I think. So
yeah.
we have ourselves, and we have Chuck Altman from Detroit and Glenn Sandberg from Gulfport, and we have our speaker, and Mark can't make it because he's on a plane, and that's about it. There's about 6 of us.
Yeah, I got an email that was pretty clear, but I think I did only get one.
Well, it wasn't as clear as they are other months.
Hmm.
So we're just wondering if we should go ahead and then try to use the recording of the call.
Or we could reschedule it for next week.
Virginia can't do that on next Tuesday night. Our very good moderator. And Michael says he's willing to play it anyway. You have an abbreviated call. He can do it next week. Rich Gardner says he's available, whichever.
Well, Sally and Virginia, whatever you decide on, I'll go.
Well, I think we should go ahead and get started. I want to welcome everybody to the call that is here, and then we will post this online, and we can post it to our various Facebook pages afterwards also, get the word out. I want to welcome, my name is Virginia Hoffler. I'm the co-chair of And Wars and Occupations for PDA with Sally Weiss, who's also on the call. We're at opposite ends of the country. So I want to welcome everybody to the call and welcome our guest speaker, Michael Eisenter, who is the National Coordinator of U.S. Labor Against the War, co-founder of Network for New Priorities, and a fully engaged anti-war activist who works every day to end the war in Afghanistan and cut the Pentagon budget. Michael, welcome to the call. I understand you're going to talk about the U.S.-Afghanistan Strategic Partnership Agreement and also the Danny Davis revelations. So welcome, Michael. Take it away.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to talk with you, and I hope this will be more of a conversation than a one-way presentation. And since there aren't a lot of people on the call, we can probably have more conversation. What I thought we would do initially is just to be sure everybody's on the same page by outlining what the strategic partnership agreement is all about. The agreement is an extension of an ongoing understanding and agreement that previously existed between the governments of the United States and Afghanistan concerning the presence of U.S. occupation forces or guest military, NATO and U.S. military. What this agreement does, however, is it creates a framework under which the occupation could theoretically continue for another 12 years until 2024. The agreement itself is not very explicit or detailed. In fact, it's more of an agreement to negotiate an agreement than anything else. It leaves all of the details to future negotiations, particularly the status of forces agreement concerning the role and conduct of U.S. Forces. It does establish a commitment on the part of the United States in general to financially and militarily support the government of Afghanistan and to do so in terms of both direct and indirect aid, political support, and very importantly, military support. And the actual framework of the or definition of military support is left very, very loose. There's an emphasis on developing the capacity of the Afghan national security forces to defend the country themselves. But it doesn't in any way restrict the United States to some kind of an advisory role. And in fact, in discussions that are going on in the media and around the announcement, it's been made pretty clear that U.S. Combat forces will remain, particularly in the form of special forces, doing counterinsurgency warfare, both as advisors and combatants, in both a training capacity and a fighting capacity. So this is hardly the direction that we had hoped the Obama administration would take. It's also very clearly an agreement that is designed for the maximum impact in the election campaign, in Obama's re-election campaign, that gives him the best of both worlds. It allows him to claim that he's winding the war down at the same time that he gets to keep forces there and keep his hand in, so to speak, micromanaging the affairs of the Afghan regime. We ought to keep in mind that the Karzai regime is not a legitimate government. It was installed essentially by the United States. He was handpicked and anointed. The elections that have taken place there are really sham elections. He would not survive more than a day or two if the U.S. were actually to pull out. His political existence depends entirely in his relationship as a client of the United States, a client regime. So all of his bluster and blunder and, you know, remarks about the United States violations of Afghan sovereignty are really kabuki theater. They're posturing. He's also completely and thoroughly corrupt. His brother is a drug runner and a warlord. His family is deeply involved in all of the most corrupt practices in the country. Basically, every government position in the country is up for sale, and part of the effort of the United States to legitimize this government is undermined by its inherent corrupt character. The agreement to continue financial aid is framed in a way that actually makes it clear the U.S. is supporting the regime, not the sovereignty of the country. And one of the ways you can tell that is that they mention the term sovereignty and sovereign country numerous times throughout this agreement, as if somehow by repeating it over and over, it makes it true. And in fact, if they really did respect the sovereignty of Afghanistan, they wouldn't have to keep repeating themselves. But they felt the need to do so. What's more important than the agreement is how we respond to it. My initial reaction was, and this is before the terms of the agreement were released, that this sure looks and sounds like a treaty to me. And if it is a treaty, it should be subject to the constitutional requirement of Senate ratification, which is a two-thirds vote. What I have said is that, at a minimum, the Congress, both houses, should be conducting hearings on the terms of this agreement. And then the hearings should be the basis on which a determination is made whether or not this rises to the level of a treaty and therefore requires Senate ratification. But nothing prevents the Congress, either house, from conducting these hearings even before a determination is made that there is indeed or is not a treaty. And this kind of brings us into the revelations of Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis. His interviews have now appeared in a number of places, Rolling Stone, Democracy Now!, and including, importantly, in the Armed Forces Journal. And I thought that was probably the place I wanted to look first, because anything that is published by and for the armed forces would be of some particular import and relevance in terms of understanding what exactly he's saying. And so I went through the article, and I'd like to just share some of his revelations, although if you've listen to the Democracy Now! Interview, you probably are familiar with them. But in the event you haven't, I'll cover some of these. He starts out very clearly. What I saw bore no resemblance to the rosy official statements by U.S. military leaders about conditions on the ground. Now, he is speaking about his role in the course of 12 months traveling 9,000 miles around Afghanistan, assessing the Army's rapid equipping force. He was responsible for determining what the military needed in the way of equipment and support to carry out its mission. He explains that he interviewed hundreds of military personnel, everything from the lowly grunt on up to commanding officers, and that the story that he was given in his own eyewitness observations is that there's a wide discrepancy between the kind of happy talk that comes out of the Pentagon about the progress being made and the reality on the ground. He says, I heard many stories of how insurgents controlled virtually every piece of land beyond eyeshot of a U.S. or international security assistance force base. In fact, Karzai is described as essentially the president of Kabul, and not much more than that. He cannot travel the country safely and largely stays locked up in Kabul, surrounded by his military forces, because he has no legitimacy anywhere else in the country. He says that, "I saw little to no evidence that the local governments were able to provide for the basic needs of their people, and I observed Afghan security forces colluding with the insurgency." And he goes on to cite some examples of that. Afghan policemen rarely leave the cover of their checkpoints. In that part of the province, the Taliban literally run free. He's referring to one particular place he visited. He goes on to say, "Already across this region, many elements of the security forces have made deals with the Taliban that they won't shoot at the Taliban and the Taliban won't shoot at them. This is the force that's going to take over security of the country." He also makes clear that if this were the first, second, third, even the fourth year of the occupation, some of this might be understandable. But after 10 years, with all of the talk about the success of the surge, of the fact that the government is able to govern in more parts of the country, that the Taliban is disorganized and on the run, all of these things that are being said are just a crock of you-know-what. And the American people are being fed that kind of pablum to justify the continuing occupation, and at the same time to give the impression that everything is going to work out just swell. He describes it as effectively spinning the road to victory by eliminating content that illustrates the full scale of the challenges that are faced there. They ignore or understate the Taliban and insurgent gains from 2002 to 2009, and ignore the problems caused by the weak and corrupt Afghan governance. To understate the risks posed by sanctuaries in Pakistan, and to spin the value of tactical military victories while ignoring the steady growth of Taliban influence and control. This is at wide variance with what we're hearing. So the issue of hearings is not simply to review the agreement, but to demand that hearings be held so that his revelations can be the subject of congressional scrutiny and review. Quite clearly, I think that they've avoided calling him to testify, because were he to do so, all kinds of things would start to unravel, and they would have an increasingly difficult time rationalizing the situation on the ground and the lack of progress. In the meantime, our forces are having to endure ongoing casualties, increasing numbers being permanently maimed as a result of IED explosions. He, in his report, talks about the cynicism of the troops, people sort of joking about whether they are going to lose a limb, and which limb they would lose and which they'd rather lose if they had to lose one. This is the kind of mood that our military forces are in. And when they come back, of course, they are not given the kind of support or treatment that they require, particularly for the invisible wounds of war, the psychological wounds, the repetitive traumatic brain injury that results when your vehicle is blown up or you're in the presence or nearby to one of these explosions. So the real question is, how do we force this question into the election campaign? How do we compel candidates to account for why they have failed to demand from the leadership hearings on these questions? Why there is so much congressional silence about the obvious failure of the mission and its likely continuing failure in the future. So that I think that kind of opens up the issue, and you know, we can get into deeper conversation in a back and forth Q&A. I did want to, however, move a little bit past this subject to a broader question, and that is, it's not sufficient for us to simply challenge the U.S. policy in Afghanistan as if somehow addressing that will remedy the problem, because the problem is not the policy in Afghanistan alone. It's the problem of a completely militarized foreign policy. And unless we are prepared to challenge the administration on the underlying assumptions of this militarized foreign policy, we will be forever responding, reacting, chasing after the next military confrontation, because military confrontation is built into this militarized foreign policy. And quite clearly, we've seen evidence of that in both Libya and Syria most recently, and we see what's happening in Yemen and the saber-rattling going on with Iran. And that raises the question of how to tackle a conversation with people about this militarized foreign policy, because it can be so overwhelming, so overarching, that it's difficult for people to wrap their minds around it. And I think one of the ways to do that is to talk about particularly what I call the economic crisis foreign policy nexus, and that is the intersection between this foreign policy and the economic crisis. And in my work in the labor movement, that's particularly why we've made such a commitment to the new priorities work, the new priorities network nationally, and here in the Bay Area where I live, the new priorities campaign, trying to help people to understand that there will be progress on no domestic front of any sort so long as we continue the foreign policy that we have. The Pentagon is going to continue to suck up the majority of resources in this country. Right now, it's 59 cents out of every discretionary tax dollar, and it'll go down to 57 cents in the next budget, the 2013 budget. The Pentagon is conducting a full court press to reverse the requirements of sequestration, so that they bear none of the, or very little of the burden that sequestration would impose upon them. You'll recall that the requirement is that if the Congress is unable to reach an agreement, that automatically cuts will be divided 50% between national security and non-national security expenditures. Now, the term is national security, not military. And that means it includes certain programs of the State Department. It includes the nuclear arsenal. It includes some veterans programs. And what we're going to see is the effort on the part of the generals to simply shift the burden of sacrifice off their backs and onto the backs of, number one, the troops, who will be deprived of veteran services by cutting a disproportionate share from the veterans' benefits side of the national security budget. And then also our domestic programs, which will bear the overwhelming brunt of the cuts that will be incurred if, in fact, the Congress does protect the Pentagon, because then an even greater burden will be borne by domestic programs. And if the cuts in domestic spending that we've seen so far are an indication, we can double and triple the impacts if that's the course that is taken by the Congress. So I think that's probably a good opening, and we can kind of move on into a Q&A conversation.
I would like to ask you a question, Michael. In that regard, do you see hope in the fact that France just elected a socialist as their new president, who is was elected on the basis that he's no longer going along with this austerity theory? And one of the first things he's going to do is pull his troops out of Afghanistan?
Well, I suspect, if I understand the situation correctly, that he's going to have more control over pulling his troops out of Afghanistan than he will have over reversing the austerity regime, because the austerity regime is a Europe-wide one, and France is going to have to renegotiate the terms of the agreement with Germany in order to be able to do that. He's going to be under intense pressure, obviously, from his base in order to fulfill his election pledges. But to be quite honest with you, I tend to be cynical about these things. We understand from our own experience with Obama that election pledges and promises are often a lot of hot air. They don't translate into actual change in the course of policy. But I do think that they are going to pull their troops out, but probably not before 2013 by any means.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but do you think there's some way we can relate that? That somehow people can see that attitudes are changing, you know, that people on the ground are making a difference, like over here with the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, that keep on saying, you know, we have to tax the rich more and stop the military spending and use it for more domestic spending. Is that something we can maybe learn from them? I'm not sure what they did to get that done. I'm not that well-versed, but I certainly have been watching the last month.
Keep in mind that theirs is a parliamentary system, and it's a very different political environment, institutionally and ideologically. There's also a much better and well-organized left in France. So I don't think you can make a one-to-one kind of translation to the U.S. context, but you put your finger on something that is very important, and that is that Occupy has changed the civil discourse, the debate that had been exclusively about austerity, debt, and deficits now is also about poverty, inequality, and the disproportionate power of corporate America over American political life. We need to keep that part of the discourse alive. There's going to be an intense effort to squelch that debate in the election. The fact that the corporations have such freewheeling access to the media and can spend untold tens of millions of dollars, we're going to have to find ways in which we bring our message to people that that take into account that folks are going to be exposed to this extraordinarily intense propaganda campaign. And it's a propaganda campaign in which the two parties are active participants. They collude with the corporate agenda. I was just looking at something. I just before I came on, I received an article from anti-war forces in Afghanistan, and in this article, these are Afghan peace forces. They talk about the fact that you don't have a Democratic and Republican party; you have a war party. It's a war party with two wings, and our political work has got to take into account that that's the reality. So we have, there's a heavy burden on us to do political education, to be actively out bird-dogging candidates, including progressive candidates, because we've seen more than once where people who are widely believed to be progressive fold under the pressure or seek to compromise or to accommodate in order to survive. We've got to create the countervailing pressure.
I had a question. Is the strategic partnership agreement available physically,
yes,
still physically rather than commentary?
Yes. I actually downloaded a copy. And I think in the links that Sally and Virginia sent out, I believe there was a link to the document.
Yes.
Certainly,
yes,
it can be made available.
Okay, great.
And that
thank
link is to the White House site. So it is available on the White House site, but it was in the notice that you received about this call. There is a link there.
It is only 9 pages long. And as I say, most of it is an agreement to continue negotiating over details. So just going back to that for a minute, if this does not rise to the level of a treaty, certainly what they're talking about will if they negotiate these subsequent agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, it's important to note that even Karzai acknowledges that he is required to bring this agreement to his parliament, and in the language of the ratification, let me see if I can find it here. Yeah, this agreement shall enter into force when the parties notify one another through diplomatic channels of the completion of their respective internal legal requirements necessary for the entry into force of this agreement. And then it says it'll remain in force until 2024, and the parties can change it at any time or amplify or supplement it. So that was a bow towards Karzai, who said, probably in negotiations, I can't just sign this thing. I've got to go to my parliament. And why the U.S. Congress isn't insisting on the same obligation on the part of the Obama administration is disconcerting. And I think, again, it's because of election politics. They don't want to have to subject his decisions to scrutiny, because doing so is going to unveil all kinds of things that are inconvenient for his re-election.
Just a side note on that. I'm from Michigan, and Carl Levin is one of my senators. And shortly after this strategic partnership agreement was signed, I got an email from Levin saying that he was in Afghanistan when Obama signed the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
There were other senators there, and Levin was praising this as an end to the war. So that was sort
That's
of smart on Obama's part to bring some of these senators aboard.
Yeah, that was absolutely the spin that they're putting on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to break through that in the media. So, for example, I don't know if you were aware of it, but Kevin Martin and I, even before the details of the agreement were released, co-authored an op-ed piece that was published in Common Dreams. What I would encourage PDA to do is to get people writing op-eds, do letters to the editor, saturate as much of the media as we can with the questions, with the critical questions, and the countervailing arguments.
Well, and I think another way, we're all involved in elections going on in our own communities, and that those are certainly questions we can be asking our candidates.
That's right.
And that'll, you know, here in Arizona, we tend to have a lot of debates, so they're in public forums, and if you can get a question in, it you know, a lot of people hear it and can certainly start thinking about it and educating these people on them. And it's a good place also to bring flyers, you know, with some of these questions and some links, so that afterwards people can go back and look at these links and educate themselves further. I truly believe that's one of PDA's goals, is to educate people on all these issues so we can ask the intelligent question of our candidates and our elected officials.
Yeah, and then one other thing we can do is get on talk radio. Get in there and mix it up with the right wingers. We should never forfeit that terrain to the ultra right.
Absolutely.
So that really puts a premium on developing talking points, training people to talk about this stuff, holding workshops where people can do role plays, figuring out how to answer questions.
Mm-hmm.
I see that the UFPJ Afghanistan Working Group is releasing a packet of materials on Afghanistan, including fact sheets, quotes, polling data, op-eds, news articles. So there's a lot of raw material there that can be distributed to PDA chapters.
Okay, and we should get them up on our site here, on our page. We will get that up. I did just receive that today, so I haven't had a chance to go through it all, but definitely I'll go through it and get some of it put up on our page here. And we're coming to about 15 minutes till the hour. Would you like to say anything in conclusion, Michael, before we move on?
Well, I guess the conclusion is where I ended up, and that is the importance of grounding our critique of Afghanistan and the broader issue of foreign policy, and then grounding that critique in making the connections to the economic consequences. And one of the questions that has come up, particularly in union audiences, is, well, what about all of the people in this country whose jobs depend on the military, on defense contracts? And One of the kind of shocking facts is that nobody can actually tell you how many people that is. There has never been a comprehensive study. No member of Congress has any idea. They can tell you how many people work for Lockheed Martin or General Electric, but they can't tell you how many people owe their livelihood to national security contracts. And one of the things that the Congress has been very shrewd about is guaranteeing that there are, well, actually it's the industry that is shrewd, that there are defense contracts in virtually every congressional district in the country, which creates a vested interest in maintaining the status quo, making it much more difficult for people to challenge these broader underlying assumptions of U.S. foreign policy. There are right now about 1,000 major U.S. military bases outside the United States around the world. We're paying for that at the tune of about a quarter of $1 trillion a year, $250 billion a year. There are about 300,000 U.S. troops stationed at those bases, not including those that are committed right now to the war. This is the imperial ring of enforcement. You know, the military wing of the imperial enterprise to maintain the status quo and to stomp down any challenge in any part of the world. And we're building new bases as I speak. About to establish a new base in Australia, for example. Another one in Korea. So getting back to a minute for the congressional district stuff, we've got to be able to talk to people about what a transition to a peace economy would look like. And I think there's a natural basis for an alliance here between the peace movement and the environmental movement, because the very same issues about sustainability and transition away from a carbon-based economy are the same kinds of questions that you have to deal with. So my response to this is simple. If you look at the size of the national security budget, which exceeds $1 trillion a year, it's about 1.25, there's enough money in there that we could guarantee to every defense industry worker either full pay, benefits, training allowances, relocation subsidies, early retirement, any of the options that would insulate them from having to bear the price of a transition to a peace economy. And the communities in which these businesses operate can be held harmless with regard to the impact on the tax base. There's so much money in that budget that it's possible to do this. And of course, none of this is going to happen in the course of a single year. It's going to be a decades long process. But you've got to make the moral commitment and the value judgments, as well as the policy decisions, that's the road we're going to take before you're able to actually begin the process. And the place probably where it's easiest to start right now is in demanding the dismantling of the 8,500 nuclear warheads that the United States maintains. There's virtually no justification for maintaining that Cold War arsenal, and we ought to be in the process of dismantling it ASAP.
I agree. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Alice from Bisbee joining very late.
Hi, Alice.
Hi.
All right. Well, our next topic is Norman Solomon, certainly, in my view, the most anti-war peace activist who is our endorsed candidate in Northern California. He does have a call coming up here right after this call, half hour after this call is over. So is Connor on the line, and is Mike Fox on the line?
Hey, Virginia, Connor here.
Hey, Connor.
Fox here as well.
Okay, hi, Mike. Connor, you want to tell us a little bit what's going to be happening with this call?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thanks, Virginia. Thanks, Sally. And thank you, Michael, for a very insightful call so far tonight. I'm just here to let folks know, I think everybody on this call knows about Norman. I don't think we need to spend too much time talking about Norman, other than it's like, you know, the best way to describe Norman is like, as if, you know, one of us, you know, concerned citizens, activists, organizers running for Congress. Norman has been with PDA from the very beginning. He's been part of this issue team from the very beginning. He's been on numerous calls. He's pretty much helped us write the mission statement for this issue team. Norman is PDA true and true. He's the co-chair of our Healthcare Not Warfare campaign, and he needs our help. Today, we're exactly 1 month out from the election. Voting by mail started. He's running in the 2nd Congressional District, if there is new people on the call tonight, 2nd Congressional District of California. He's running in a seat that has been vacated by Lynn Woolsey, who's also one of our board members. So it's crucially important that we help as much as possible with Norman's campaign. It's in a very tight race. It's an open primary, so that means there will be Democrats and Republicans on the ballot. There are numerous candidates on this ballot. We need to get them into the top two, so it's a top two primary. So if we get them up into the top two, he will advance to November. So it's a mixed bag. We think we're aiming, you know, to get him. You know, we believe we can get him into the top two, and then push him forward to November, get some momentum behind him, get more endorsements, etc. But we really need to get him, you know, into the top two come June 5th. As I said, voting by mail started today, and you know, you're probably wondering how can we help as PDA? What can we do from various locations across the country? Right now, for instance, there's house parties that we're putting on for Norman. Norman made a fantastic movie called War Made Easy, talking about the military-industrial complex. It's narrated by Sean Penn. It's a fantastic movie. Right now, across the country, we've got 26 house parties showing that. Goal is to bring more people in, watch the movie, and then get them active within Norman's campaign, whether it be phone banking, donating to Norman, whatever it is. We need to get more people doing that. There's been numerous email blasts sent out about that to folks, so hopefully people are aware of it. Virginia has one just coming up this coming weekend. Sally had one last night. I don't know, Sandy's organizing another one. So I know a lot of your folks on the call tonight are organizing house parties. We need more of them. Please spread the word as much as possible. Mike Fox is on the line. He's going to come on and talk a little bit about more specifics, but we need more volunteers to pick up the phone and make phone calls. This is going to be an election that's going to be won by PDA people around the country, picking up the phone and making calls into voters in the district of the 2nd Congressional District of California. Really important. So Mike is going to talk that up. But again, you know, if we want a real peace candidate in Congress, like when you think about, you know, the Barbara Lee bill right now that's in Congress, imagine having Norman Solomon there, you know, arguing for that on the floor of the House. Like, how fantastic would that be? So we can make that difference. We're 1 month out, as I said. Voting by mail started today. The election is June 5th. You know, we need as many PDA people and anti-war voices as possible to get, you know, the vote out. We're working with numerous peace groups right now to do a joint email blast into all the various peace groups around the country to, you know, push the cause forward. Jeff Cohen wrote a fantastic article yesterday. One of our former board members was on Huffington Post talking about Norman. So, you know, it's just letting your, you know, people in your communities, your, you know, peace groups, et cetera, know about Norman, educating them and, you know, telling them that we really need him in Congress. So that's pretty much all I have to say. There's another call coming up in 30 minutes where Norman is going to be on, and it's not up in the calendar. It's a special call. We did an email blast out about it. We asked people to sign up through Mike Fox, and Mike is going to come on. So Mike will give you the details of the call. If you're on the call and you know me, just, you can shoot me an email. I'll get you the phone number, Connor, C-O-N-O-R, at pdamerica.org. Just shoot me an email, I can get you the details of the call. But without further ado, I know we're pretty much up against the clock here. We've got 4 minutes left. I'm going to pass it on to Virginia, who's going to quarterback it and maybe give it to Mike. So thank you, everybody. Great call tonight.
Okay, thanks, Connor. Mike?
Yeah, I think bottom line, Connor covered it. We are going to have a call coming up with Norman as well as David Siegel, who is the executive director of Demand Progress, has an absolutely huge email database, and he's on board in a big way to try to drive callers in our direction. I can tell you, here's our goal, gang. I'm dead serious. Here's our goal. If we can get 90,000 telephone calls into that district, we can win this thing. We can definitely make sure that he gets in, okay? Now, have we ever done 90,000 telephone calls before as an organization? No, but we've also never started this far out. And we're in better shape right now, excuse me, we have more folks signed up as phone bankers right now than we have in previous campaigns where we only organized for a couple of weeks. And really, we've only had our ears pinned back here since about the 22nd. Of the 22nd of April. I always hope that we're further along than we are at any given moment, but bottom line, we are moving in the right direction. But like Connor had suggested, we have to stay focused. This is our primary goal in life in PDA between now and June 5th, and preferably today because vote-by-mail ballots drop today. And there will be a discussion. You'll get to hear from...
Thanks, Michael. Be talking to you soon.
Good news, Mike. I think we might have lost Mike.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks, Connor. Sally, you want to add anything to any of these? We're getting close to the end of the call now.
Well, we were considering talking a little bit about other endorsed candidates today, and that we're not entirely happy with some of our endorsed candidates because they seem to be buying into the very thing that the main part of the call was about, which is a militarized kind of foreign policy. And specifically here in Massachusetts, we have a surprise, let's say, from our candidate for the Senate, Elizabeth Warren, because if you read her website and you read down about Iran, then you find out that she's not questioning the propaganda that's put out. And in fact, she doesn't even realize that that she's not her facts are not the same as the facts coming out
Laura.
Of the administration. And I think you said that that in Arizona you have some trouble with Iran. We have the extended war, and then we have the impending war of Iran. And you know, they're both grievous to all of us. Somebody trying to say something.
Right, absolutely. We are in the midst of an endorsement process here in Arizona, and we also have a candidate that's very good on all the issues except for Iran. That seems that there are a lot of people that are buying into this idea that that they're going to attack Israel any minute now, when in fact there's no proof of that. So it's very difficult, and we just have to keep educating again. Educate our candidates, ask them the questions, where's the proof of this? You don't believe, you know, your intelligence? You know, what is the deal here? So this is an ongoing problem for candidates that are good on all the other issues. But that, and it's. I think the only thing we can do is continue to educate, continue to bring them articles, continue to question why they believe what they believe.
Can I ask a question, Alice and Bisbee? I know we're not PDA is.